Good day. Today is Wednesday, 11th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and listened to this programme, or whichever part of this programme you want to watch and listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, today, 11th March 2026, it seems to me that it's becoming increasingly difficult to argue with the proposition that the United States and Israel are finding themselves in a long war against Iran. If there were expectations, as I and now I think pretty much everybody believes, that the war would be a short one, that the killing of the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei would precipitate the collapse of the Iranian government and political system and result in regime change in that country, well, those expectations are being dispelled. Before the war started, I pointed out in several programmes that for there to be regime change in Iran, there would need to be, in practical terms, some defection from the Iranian government of at least a part of the Iranian armed forces. In fact, there'd been a series of articles across the media, including an interesting one by Seymour Hersh, but I read articles elsewhere, that claimed that the US and Israeli intelligence had been in contact with senior Iranian military officials, and that there was every expectation that in the event of a crisis, some sections of the Iranian military would peel away, would turn against the government, and by the way, against the IRGC, and that this would result in a quick collapse of the war, of the regime and of the political system, and a quick end to the war. And in fact, I can remember that I discussed, both on this channel and on the Duran, that the first night following the attacks would be critical. If there was no sign of troop movements in Tehran, suspicious troop movements, suggestions that some kind of military uprising against the government was underway, then whilst it would be difficult to say conclusively that such a thing would not happen, if the government of Iran, if the political system there got through the first day and night intact, then the clock would start ticking and it would become increasingly less likely with every passing day and night that an uprising did not take place, that one would take place, and the United States and Israel would quickly, in that case, find themselves in exactly the scenario they had hoped to avoid, which was a long war of attrition against Iran. Well, I think I'm right in saying that we are now very close to the start of the third week of the war, and it seems to me that there's been no sign of any uprising, any dissent within Iran's armed forces. They all seem to be working actively to defend Iran from what, by any measure, must be considered an aggressive attack upon that country, an aggressive and illegal attack upon that country. So there's been no sign of any dissent from the military. And I think after 2 weeks, we have to conclude that that is now extremely unlikely to happen. It may conceivably take place if the system in Iran starts to unravel under the constant hammering of the blows that Iran is facing. But that would be a process that would probably take many months. And that, by American and Israeli standards, and by the standards of the global economy, is already a long war. And I would add that, frankly, my own view on the contrary is that the longer the war continues, the stronger the consolidation of the government in Iran is going to be, and the less likely we're going to see things like that, rebellions by the armed forces or protests in the street, the less likely we are to see that happen. Now, I say all of that, there's been a very interesting article today in the Financial Times, which has been looking at the situation in Iran. Unusually, it appears to be written by a journalist in Iran, Naimeh Bozorgmer, who, from the name, appears to be Iranian. This person appears to be based in northern Tehran, and this person also, from what I can tell, is very sympathetic to the anti-government protests in Iran that took place in January, and mostly speaks to the people who back in January were strongly supporting those protests. Anyway, this article in the Financial Times tells us that there has been a mood swing in Iran, that people no longer expect that the government is going to collapse, that the expectation is that the government, far from collapsing, is growing stronger. And many of these people who supported the protests in January are now changing their minds, and some of them are drifting into outright support for the government in light of what they have come to see as an attack on their country. And there's reference, for example, to an individual called Mandana. That apparently is not her real name. She said that the experience of the last terrifying days have shattered her belief that the government is about to collapse. Airstrikes have targeted not just military sites and senior regime figures, but have repeatedly hit civilian infrastructure. Over the weekend, Tehran was enveloped in toxic black smog after Israel bombed fuel depots around the city. There's been many reports about this, and reports that Tehran has also suffered from acid rain. The report goes on to say that on Tuesday, massive explosions caused widespread blackouts. And Mandana, who seems to have had, if I may say, a remarkably optimistic, some would say naive, expectation of American and Israeli intentions and actions, says to this interviewer from the Financial Times, "We weren't supposed to be bombed. Our city, our country, this wasn't supposed to happen." And she asks, why could the Americans not achieve in Iran what they achieved in Venezuela? And the article then continues, approaching 2 weeks into the war, no signs exist of the sort of anti-regime unrest that broke out across the country in January. Instead, many, even those who loathe the Islamic Republic, appeared to have recoiled at the destruction and comments, including Donald Trump's threat to target electricity production facilities if the regime escalated. One sociologist in Tehran, who is critical of the regime and the war, said there was anecdotal evidence of a growing sense of nationalism emerging from the war, as happened during Israel's 12-day conflict against Iran last year, when people rallied around the flag. The fear of Iran's destruction is increasingly uniting people as they fear the consequences of such a large-scale conflict, the sociologist said, asking not to be named. Now, before the conflict began, even as it became increasingly obvious to me that the conflict was coming, that an attack on Iran was coming, I repeatedly said several things. First, that the objective was clearly regime change. Secondly, if regime change was not achieved, that would be a defeat for the United States and Israel, however they packaged it, given that regime change was clearly their announced and indisputable objective. Thirdly, that in order to achieve regime change, there had to be internal division within Iran. The Financial Times says that there is no internal division within Iran, that the article that I've just read has a sociologist say that there is a consolidation and increasing support for the government. That is also consistent with the images we're seeing from the streets of large-scale demonstrations in Iran supporting the government, not opposing it. And there are also reports, growing reports, which appear to originate with European diplomats in Tehran who are reporting back to their governments that there is no sign of dissent, no sign of splits in the leadership, no cracks, no visible cracks in the system whatsoever. So, if this is correct, and if this remains the case, then definitely we are in a long war, unless Donald Trump seeks the off-ramp that I talked about yesterday, though in that case he will still come out a loser, something which probably his vanity would find difficult to accept, and he would still suffer significant political damage, probably terminal political damage, just saying. But anyway, we are in a long war, and to be frank, my own personal view is that if things continue the way they are, in 3 months, in 6 months' time, I doubt if the war continues at its current level that anything the United States and Israel can realistically do will change the calculus. I think that with every passing day, with every week, with every month that the government in Iran remains in place, the prospects of its overthrow diminish. And that is strategic defeat. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, formerly of the US military, someone who once served as Colin Powell's chief of staff, has been saying this. Professor John Mearsheimer has gone further still, and he says that the United States has already lost in Iran. Perhaps it's still a bit too early to say, but everything points to a long war that Israel and the United States are unprepared to wage, and a long war which will achieve the opposite effect to the one they set out to achieve. Instead of overthrowing or weakening the governing system in Iran, they are currently strengthening it. Well, with all of that, let's now turn to what is going on in the war. And, well, yesterday I discussed at great length the various possibilities of Donald Trump looking for an off-ramp and of Donald Trump calling Vladimir Putin. And by the way, on that point, my increasing feeling is that the call did not go very well at all. I noticed that Donald Trump himself is saying very little about the call with Putin. I think he didn't like at all the things that Putin said to him. Steve Witkoff, his hapless envoy, who, by the way, is supposed next week to be flying to Istanbul to meet the Russians and the Ukrainians all over again. Istanbul being once again the venue for all the talks, a venue which Zelensky is known to detest for all sorts of reasons. Anyway, we'll come to that later in the programme. Anyway, Steve Witkoff repeats his claim that the Russians have given assurances that Russia is not providing intelligence assistance to Iran. He says that Trump brought up this topic with Putin over the course of the telephone call that they each had with each other yesterday, and that Putin supposedly assured Trump that Russia is not providing intelligence to Iran. Well, of course, that may be true. I don't believe so myself. If Trump asked Putin about that, would Putin have confirmed that the Russians were providing intelligence to Iran? Would he not either give an evasive answer or perhaps an outright denial? Isn't that much more likely? Just saying. It's not as if Putin by now has any reason to trust Trump, and given the undoubted distrust that now exists between the two men and the even wider distrust of Trump that exists in Russia, would Putin feel under any obligation to tell Trump if Russia was providing intelligence assistance to Iran? Just saying. Personally, I don't place any weight at all on these denials, if they were ever made, or, and even less, on Witkoff's assertions about them, given all the many things that Witkoff has said and his disastrous mishandling of the negotiations with the Iranians before the war began. Incidentally, there is a story circulating that Witkoff and Kushner lacked the technical knowledge to understand the extent of the concessions that Araghchi and the Iranians were making over the course of the negotiations, and that they came away from the negotiations assuming that the Iranians were taking a harder line than they actually were. And interestingly, this interpretation of Witkoff's and Kushner's mishandling of the negotiations is coming from the Omani from the Ahmadi mediators, or appears to be coming from the Ahmadi mediators. Personally, I think that is far too kind. Whilst I absolutely believe that Witkoff and Kushner were never the right people to be conducting negotiations at this level, that undoubtedly they lacked the expertise on the technical questions that the Omanis are talking about. My own clear view is that throughout the whole negotiation process, both this month and last month and before the attack in June last year, I think that Witkoff in particular, and Kushner, who of course joined him later, I've no doubt at all that they were engaged in an elaborate exercise of stringing the Iranians along. The Iranians, by the way, certainly think so. And over the last couple of days, the Iranian media has been republishing pictures of Witkoff and Kushner visiting the USS Abraham Lincoln, the carrier. And anyway, I thought at the time, I said at the time, that if there was any real good faith in the negotiations, that was a disastrously misjudged visit. But of course, I don't think that there was any good faith in the negotiations, and the Iranians no longer think so, and they are publishing these pictures as proof of that. Anyway, coming back to all of the talk of the off-ramp that I was talking about yesterday, of course, the talk of the off-ramp was entirely predictably followed by further talk of escalation. Much of it now coming from Pete Hegseth. Pete Hegseth seems to spend every day now saying that the next attack on Iran is going to be even greater, even more powerful than the last attack. And it is indeed the case that Iran is being pounded. And for all I know, the level and intensity of American strikes is indeed intensifying. Having said that, it also seems to me that we are now clearly in the law of diminishing returns. The Iranians have absorbed the massive shocks of the initial attacks. They are adjusting to the attacks that are taking place. Iran remains, as I have said already and many times, an enormous country with an extremely complex geography, with a population of 93 million people. It is impossible for the United States and Israel to pound Iran into oblivion. There's an article in, of all places, The Guardian, by a journalist called Paul Rogers. I'm not familiar with him. He says that this is now, in light of the failure of everything else, essentially the American and Israeli plan to just go on bombing and bombing still more and conducting more and more strikes against Iran, hoping that eventually Iran breaks. This person, Mr. Rogers, points out that this is also what was basically tried in Gaza, but Hamas there remains in being and is still an armed force, despite the bombing having been intended to destroy Hamas. And, well, Iran, which is obviously on an entirely different scale from Gaza, one an enormous country, twice the size of Ukraine, with a population of 93 million. The Americans and the Israelis can never achieve the kind of aerial dominance over Iran that the Israelis undoubtedly did achieve in Gaza. And on that point, by the way, I would just again reiterate the point that has been made many times by many others, that the idea that countries can be bombed into submission, that governments can be regime changed from the sky, has been consistently refuted by events. It didn't happen during the Second World War. It didn't happen during the Korean War. It didn't happen during the Vietnam War. It didn't happen in Iraq. And obviously, it didn't happen in Gaza. Why believe when that it is going to happen in Iran? On the contrary, as I said earlier in this program, I believe that this bombing is going to strengthen the government. It's not going to weaken it. But anyway, alongside the bombing, there is the various tactical and strategic angles. There are now reports that the Iranians are beginning the mining of the Straits of Hormuz, and this has provoked a furious response on Truth Social by Donald Trump. He has joined Pete Hegseth, giving warnings that if the Iranians do that, he will do even more fire and damage to them than they have received up to now. Well, I have already explained why I don't think the Iranians are going to be intimidated by that threat. There's also been claims by the Pentagon that they have already destroyed 16 Iranian mine layers. But from what I can decipher from the various bits of information that's been published to support this claim, that includes all Iranian mine layers within the Iranian Navy that the Americans have destroyed since the beginning of military operations roughly 2 weeks ago. So it doesn't seem as if much more has been achieved or can be achieved there. Given the geography of the Straits of Hormuz, I would have thought that it was relatively straightforward for the Iranians to mine it. I'm not an expert on sea mining, not by any means, but I doubt that you require sophisticated mine layers to do it. And for the record, the Iranians have been publishing film of their electric drones, some of which perhaps also have a mine laying role. I'm not going to speculate about that. Anyway, all of this talk of escalation that was being pouring out of the United States yesterday, even as we just had previously all the talk about the US seeking an off-ramp, well, all of that talk of escalation and all of the talk of the off-ramps sent contradictory signals to the global energy markets. And I wonder, actually, I'm starting to wonder whether the whole exercise of talking about off-ramps, even the call to Putin, might not have been intended to try to reassure global energy markets. Just saying. Firstly, we had the call to Putin. We had the reports about the release of oil from the reserves. I discussed this in a previous program. There's a longer discussion about it on Eurointelligence, which I touched on yesterday. There were reports yesterday that the IAE, the International Energy Authority, is now recommending the biggest ever release from the reserves that we have seen. And there were reports this morning that Japan, which is of course particularly vulnerable to interruptions of energy flow from the Straits of Hormuz, is going to be the first to start releasing oil from the reserves. Well, as I, the people at Eurointelligence, Eve Smith on Naked Capitalism, various others, including in the Financial Times, are all pointing out, the idea of releasing oil from the reserves is going to perhaps lessen for a short time problems in the markets. It might cushion the shortage of oil that we are seeing and lead for a certain time to lower prices. But this can only continue for a certain amount of time. And as Eurointelligence pointed out, sooner or later, the reserves have to be replenished. And that will mean taking oil out of the markets. And when that starts to happen, presumably after the war ends and the Straits of Hormuz is in some way reopened, well, when that happens, that will mean that the pressure on oil prices will be upward, which will only extend the period of higher oil prices that we are likely to see. Anyway, that was one thing that the Americans and the other G7 states, the Western states, seem now preparing to do. They're doing something else as well. They are giving false information, publishing false information to the media. Incredibly, astonishingly, a US official yesterday published an incredible claim that the US Navy had successfully escorted a tanker through the Straits of Hormuz. Now, I've been following the situation around the Straits of Hormuz very closely. I knew immediately when that message on X, that post on X appeared, that it had to be wrong. I cannot believe that the US government did not know it was wrong when it was published. And sure enough, a short time after, that post was deleted. And confirmation then began to circulate that, in fact, the post was wrong. In fact, I've seen a report, I believe it came from the US media, that the US Navy has been bombarded with requests from ship owners, from shipping companies, from insurance groups, from officials within the US government, from the Gulf states, from European officials. It's receiving incessant requests to conduct escort missions in the Gulf of Hormuz to try, in other words, to break the blockade in the Straits of Hormuz. And the US Navy is responding to all of these requests in the same way, that this is not something it feels it can do at the moment. And in fact, I understand that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, who is probably under the same kind of pressure, he also, it seemed to me, gave an evasive response. He said that the US military is studying options as to how the Straits of Hormuz can be reopened, which is in effect telling us absolutely nothing. It's telling us that there is no actual plan to reopen by force the Straits of Hormuz at this particular time. And in fact, we are receiving reports, there are reports circulating this morning, that three tankers close to the Straits of Hormuz, from various countries, by the way, flying various different flags, perhaps hoping to escape through the Straits of Hormuz, to pass through the Straits of Hormuz, maybe the captains and their crews were emboldened or embarrassed by Donald Trump's demands that they show courage. Anyway, it looks as if all three of these tankers have been attacked, but apparently by drones, presumably drones from Iran. And all of the information is that the Straits of Hormuz is closed. And as I've discussed in previous programs, as now various people have been saying, the US Navy deploying to the Straits of Hormuz would bring US Navy warships right up against the Iranian coastline in limited waters, waters where there would be limited scope to maneuver, waters that are now being mined. And, well, that would bring these American warships into a position of peril where they could be attacked by Iranian drones and Iranian missiles, from which they are currently mostly safe where they have located themselves, around 1,000 kilometers from the Iranian coastline in the Arabian Sea. Now, on that point, by the way, just very briefly, the Iranian authorities are repeating claims that they have made that the USS Abraham Lincoln, the carrier, has suffered damage as a result of an Iranian attack. The United States strongly denies that claim. I have seen no video footage of damage of the Abraham Lincoln. Perhaps the Iranians believe that the Lincoln did indeed receive damage. I am not going to assume that is the case until I see evidence of it, visual evidence of it. And up to now, I have seen none, just saying. But I don't think that the United States, for the moment, is in any position to break the blockade of the Straits of Hormuz. I think the US Navy knows it. I think probably that is the message that they are conveying to the president and his officials. Whether they're finding the president and his officials very receptive to this advice, I don't know. But desperate as the president might be to get the Straits of Hormuz reopened, to say it frankly, I don't think that he is so desperate that he will risk an American warship in these waters against the advice of the US Navy itself. Now, over the last couple of days, I've also discussed another potential military operation that the United States itself might undertake, and that is the seizure of Harg Island. I've speculated that the 82nd Airborne Division, which has been ordered to terminate its exercises, might be preparing for redeployment to the Middle East in order to conduct some kind of amphibious attack on Harg Island. I've read in the Daily Telegraph about a comment that Donald Trump made long ago when Barack Obama was president, about how if he were in Obama's position, he would put the Iranians in their place by seizing Harg Island, suggesting that this might be a long-standing idea that has become fixed in Donald Trump's mind. I've now read two reports about this. One by somebody that I've come across before, whose writings I have come across before, Ian Bremmer, and another by a blogger called Policy Tensor, who has a Substack blog with which I'm not familiar. But both of these commentators appear to have some knowledge of these things. Both of them say that an operation to capture Harg Island would be a disastrous act of folly, that Harg Island is too close to Iran. It's small. There are no structures which would provide cover for an invading force, that Harg Island would be within range, not just of Iran's drones and its missiles, but even of Iran's conventional artillery. And bear in mind, some of that artillery might be concealed in all sorts of structures on land and in nearby hills and mountains. I don't know the landscape well in this area at all, just say. But anyway, both are saying that capturing Harg Island in the face of Iranian fire might be incredibly costly of American lives. And holding on to Harg Island in the face of that fire would be all but impossible. Here, by the way, I am reminded of something that happened back in 2022 in an earlier period of the at the beginning of the Ukraine war. The Russians, for several months, occupied Snakes Island off the coast of Odessa. They were able to establish military positions there, but they found it impossible to hold on to them because Ukraine received long-range artillery from the United States and France, which could shell Russian troops on Snakes Island at will. There was a shortage of cover, and beyond a point, it became clear that holding on to Snakes Island in that kind of situation was unsustainable and made no military sense. So the Russians took the decision that they would withdraw from Snakes Island. By the way, on that, there's been a strange epilogue, because over the last couple of days, the Russians have bombed Snakes Island heavily. They've even launched these gigantic KH-32 anti-ship missiles against whatever positions the Ukrainians have there. Russian Air Force has been bombing Snakes Island with FAB bombs. Apparently, the Ukrainians have tried to establish some installations of their own on that island, and they're now busy discovering the same thing. Well, it seems to me that Harg Island is a bigger version, a much bigger, more complex version of Snakes Island. To say it simply, trying to capture Kharg Island would be walking into a trap. Without the US Navy being able to operate in the Persian Gulf to provide some degree of cover and support, without the US Air Force being able to provide continuous air cover for the ground operation, which would be an immense strain given that the US is apparently unable to operate from its air bases located closer to Iranian territory, so that US aircraft can only maintain, have to operate from bases further away and for longer, fly for much longer periods. Anyway, and without the US being able to control the, to occupy the Iranian coastline north of Kharg Island, which, as I think it was Ian Bremmer pointed out, would defeat the entire purpose of occupying Kharg Island itself. Why occupy Kharg Island if you can occupy the base, the land to the north of it? Well, unless the US could do all of these things, then deploying the 82nd Airborne Division, who are light infantry, to Kharg Island would be to drop them into the middle of a trap. And, well, there were further reports today that the Syrian Kurds are now advising the Iraqi and Iranian Kurds, whatever you do, stay out of this war. We trusted the Americans. We fought for them against IS. We did all kinds of things for them. And they betrayed us. They dumped us in favour of their ally of the present, Jalani and his government in Damascus. And if you fall for the same trick and do the Americans' work in Iran, sooner or later they will betray you, and at that point Iran and doubtless Turkey will both come for you. For the moment at least, the Kurds seem to have no interest in joining the war. So we come back to what I said. If breaking the siege, the blockade of Hormuz, is impossible, capturing Kharg Island is impossible, if there's no prospect anytime soon of anything happening with the Kurds, you just continue bombing. And, well, if we put aside the attacks on infrastructure, the attempts to bomb Iran into oblivion that we've been hearing so much about, the only plan at the moment that makes any kind of military sense, or shall we say not military sense, but has any sort of rationale behind it, is the attempts to destroy the Iranian missile launchers. But astonishingly, there is an article today in the New York Times which is now casting doubt on the previous claims that most of the Iranian missile launchers had been destroyed. It suggests that the United States has only a very vague understanding of how many missile launchers the Iranians actually have, or where they're all located and of how much actual damage has really been done. In fact, and for the moment, the Iranians continue to launch drone and missile strikes across the Middle East. Maybe not at the same level of intensity as we saw over the first 3 days, but at a sufficient level to show that they are still in the war and to cause damage. And that this is continuing to cause pressure, strains on levels of air defense interceptors has been demonstrated by another important piece of news. The Iranians appear to have successfully destroyed several radar sets in the Middle East of the American TAD system. There's even claims that they have destroyed some batteries, some actual batteries of TAD missiles. I haven't myself seen these pictures. I don't pretend to be up to date with all of these photos, and it may be that these claims are exaggerated and wrong. And bear in mind what I said in a program some days ago about AI fakes of satellite photos and of other types of photos that might be circulating. But anyway, those reports exist. But regardless, the United States yesterday apparently announced, to the dismay of the South Korean government, that the TAD system that the United States has deployed in South Korea with all of its associated radars is going to be transferred from South Korea to the Middle East, where it is currently needed. And apparently it is intended to beef up the defense of Israel. That is my understanding of it. Well, here, the best account of what this means in regional terms, in the terms of the Northeast Asia region, come from Arnaud Bertrand. Arnaud Bertrand has pointed out that when the United States some years ago took the decision to deploy the TAD system to South Korea, China, which was extremely unhappy about the deployment of the system to South Korea, mostly because it was worried that the very powerful radars that come with this system would enable the United States to keep track on aircraft and aircraft deployments in northeastern China, just saying. Anyway, China reacted very negatively. Relations between South Korea and China went into a tailspin. South Korean companies, which had previously been active in China, came under a great deal of pressure, and many of them had to close down their business. And trade between South Korea and China, which had previously been at a very high level, with China becoming South Korea's major trade partner, took a major hit. And what Arnaud Bertrand does not say is that this was a further step taken by South Korea, which spurred moves in China to improve relations with North Korea, with Kim Jong-un's government in Pyongyang, which a few years before, China's relations with that North Korean government had actually been quite bad. So, the South Koreans suffered all that damage, they suffered all that embarrassment, they lost a lot of goodwill and a lot of trade and a lot of business with China. The total financial bill probably runs in the tens of billions, and it was all for nothing, because the United States has now been obliged to take away that TAD battery from South Korea and to redeploy it to the Middle East. And of course, today, arguably, South Korea faces a greater threat from the North than it did before the TAD missile battery was deployed, because it's near neighbors, North Korea, and especially China, have been alienated by that original deployment. So the South Koreans are unhappy, and they apparently complained to the United States about this deployment, this removal of this TAD system from South Korea. But with the ongoing war, the United States has been left with no choice. And the United States apparently is still having to push back, to resist the unending flow of demands from its Gulf allies for more air defense missiles, for more Patriot missiles, again, because use of these missiles, Patriot missiles, first and foremost, has been so high. Again, I think it was in The Hill in the United States, one of the magazines in the United States, I read that the total cost of the war for the United States in the first couple of days was $6 billion. I believe, as I think I said in another program a short time ago, that the United States is spending around $1 billion a day on this war. And I also read that the United States has already launched over 1,000 Patriot and TAD missiles in the first days of this war, which is more than a year's production. In fact, we're going to start to see several years of production of Patriot missiles being used up. Compare that with what looks like it's going to be the last delivery of Patriot missiles to Ukraine, probably the last ever delivery of Patriot missiles to Ukraine, given the critical shortages of supply. The Ukrainians are now awaiting this delivery, and it will number around 35 interceptors. The United States has used over 1,000 in a couple of days against, I'm going to say, a less potent threat. Iran is now launching fewer missiles than Russia does against Ukraine, and the Russian missiles are much more powerful. And of course, Iran has not up to now shown that it has the same industrial capability that Russia has to simply continue producing huge numbers of drones. Anyway, the Ukrainians are expected to make do with 35 interceptors, air defense interceptors. Compare that with the 1,000 interceptors that the Americans have already launched. Anyway, so the whole situation looks extraordinarily difficult. Now, apparently, there are growing worries in Congress that, faced with this situation, Donald Trump and the administration are going to be left with no option other than to consider a ground operation. I've received a very, very interesting report from somebody within the United States who speaks about an American plan, or at least an idea, maybe it's not yet a plan, to try to at least remove from Iran some of Iran's enriched uranium. There are apparently problems with an outright removal of this uranium from Iran because some of it is in liquid or gaseous form, and that makes it all but impossible to take it out physically from Iran as part of some sort of covert operation. So if there's going to be that kind of operation, a special forces operation, it won't just be a special forces operation. It will have to be done, something done on a much bigger scale. Perhaps that's what the 82nd Airborne Division is going to be used for, to try to capture Isfahan, not the city, presumably, but the nuclear facilities near Isfahan, in a tunnel near which the Iranian uranium is supposed to be hidden. I have to say that conducting an operation like that deep inside the enemy's country, when the enemy has armed forces that are said to number around 1 million men, that seems to me, I mean, that's not just risky, that is unbelievably risky. I, of course, don't know whether such a plan exists. But anyway, since we're talking about apparently a lot of this uranium being, as I said, in gaseous or liquid form, it's very difficult to see how it could be extracted. There are some suggestions that the United States might conduct another attack to try to seal this uranium under the earth. But then, of course, we'd been told that that had already been done back in June. And one wonders how many of these huge bombs that the United States used for the operation it now has to spare. Anyway, it's been suggested that destroying this uranium would be one way for the United States to be able to claim victory and to seek an off-ramp. But assuming that this is even possible, and again, I wonder whether it is really possible, it still doesn't seem to me to resolve the underlying problem, which is, what if the Iranians, whatever the Americans do, whether the Americans continue bombing, what if the, or stop bombing, or destroy the enriched uranium, or extract it in some way? What did the Iranians say? Well, this makes absolutely no difference. We're not stopping our war. As the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran has already said, they choose when the war ends, not Israel and the United States. It's they who will decide if whatever the United States does in military or diplomatic terms, whether that is the moment for the war to stop. What if they decide after such a raid that the war should not stop, that they should continue launching missile and drone strikes as they're currently doing against American bases and Israeli bases across the Middle East? What then? Well, I don't know that the United States has any cogent answer to that. Already, I am starting to see words like quagmire appear, that the United States is in a quagmire. That was a term used during the later stages of the war in Vietnam by the United States, that the United States had become trapped in some kind of swamp or bog, and that it needed to somehow find its way out. And well, I saw a whole article in the Daily Telegraph, of all places, a newspaper which, by the way, has relentlessly and continuously, and for as long as I can remember, advocated for an American attack on Iran, and it has been hugely critical of the British government for the fact that it has not joined this attack on Iran. Anyway, I saw an article today in the Daily Telegraph, which is now making that comparison with the war in Iran, with the war in Vietnam in the 1960s, that comparison, which must be for Donald Trump his worst ever nightmare. Well, anyway, there it is. We have still the problems with the situation in oil markets. I've already said that releasing oil from the strategic reserves is not going to make a fundamental difference. Peddling false information about the breaking of the blockade on the Straits of Hormuz, that's not going to change the situation. Probably the decisive moment is when more of the Gulf producers start declaring force majeure and confirm that they've stopped production. Saudi Arabia, because it has the ability to export oil through the Red Sea, will never stop production entirely. But I read another report, again in the Daily Telegraph, as it happens, that the pipeline across the desert, the Arabian Desert to the Red Sea in Saudi Arabia, and the port through which the oil would be exported has only limited capacity, perhaps less than Aramco was suggesting, and that the ability to export oil on a sustained basis through this pipeline and through this port might not be that great. And this same article also made the point that the pipeline itself, and of course the port, are well within range of drone and missile strikes, which might be launched by Iran's allies, the Houthis, who have no reason to like Saudi Arabia, against whom they recently fought, and by the way, won a bitter war, just say. And of course, the Houthis have recent history, very recent history, from last year, in fact, of actually closing the Red Sea to merchant shipping. And as we saw, the United States Navy was not able to do very much about that. So, looking at this whole situation in the round, looking at what's probably going to start happening in the energy markets fairly soon, I do not for the moment see any good outcomes for the president and his officials in this. Richard Blumenthal, Senator Richard Blumenthal, and other people in Congress are apparently worrying that the president might eventually decide on some kind of full ground invasion of Iran. I read another article by another former US military official, this time written, I think it was in Unheard, again, I might be wrong, saying, showing what an absolute extraordinary act of folly that would be, talking about the enormous size of Iran, the size of its armed forces, the mountainous geography, the fact that all of the big cities are in fact ringed by mountains, deserts, and the enormous territory that would have to be crossed to reach these cities, and the fact that Tehran itself is a city of 15 million people, which if defended would impose problems of its own. This person estimated that the United States would need an invasion force of around 1.5 million men to even think about conducting an operation of this kind. Personally, I doubt that the US military in its present state would be able to put together 1.5 million men for an invasion of that kind. And I don't think that the logistics to support such an invasion exist in the Middle East. And well, if they don't, it would take probably at least a year to set them up. And well, what happens during that year? And of course, the Iranians would be aware of the attempts to create these logistics. They continue to have missiles. They continue to have drones. Probably they would want to husband the missiles, but they probably have no difficulties in continuing production of drones. They would be continuously attacking the attempts to set up these logistical hubs across the Middle East. I mean, to me, to my mind, all of this is a complete nightmare. A nightmare for any military planner. And I can't believe that General Kane and the Joint Chiefs of Staff would not point this out to the President. What the President and Prime Minister Netanyahu do in this situation, I simply don't know. But to repeat a point that I made in another recent programme, I still cannot truly understand why we are in this situation at all. Because all of the warnings about the situation were there. The possibility that the Straits of Hormuz might be closed, the enormous problems in invading Iran, Iran's size, its ability to absorb blows, the shortages of American weapon systems. I don't understand why none of these obvious facts were discussed or understood, or that the warnings went so completely unheeded. I get the impression of a tiny group of people oblivious to any warnings, to any advice that things might be more difficult and more complicated than they appeared, rushing forward to make these decisions, and to make these decisions without any proper forethought or preparation. And here we all are. I say we, because of course, if the war continues, if the economic disruption continues, then of course we all pay a price. We pay a price in our shops, at the pumps, wherever. And in Europe, well, the industries will be impacted fairly soon. And by the way, we're starting to see growing doubts in Europe as well. Again, another article in the Daily Telegraph. It's strange that these articles are now appearing in the Daily Telegraph. But an article in the Daily Telegraph pointing to splits in the European Commission. So Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, of course supports the American attack on Iran. But one of her key deputies, who is of course Spanish, has now come out and said that the attack was completely wrong, is illegal and is wrong. And President Costa, the president of the European Council, is coming out and saying the same thing. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's closest friend amongst the big West European countries, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni of Italy, she too is now under enormous pressure. Italy is also going to be, by the way, heavily stressed if there is a major increase in energy costs. Italy still has a big industrial sector. It's been hammered by the spike in energy costs as a result of the sanctions against Russia. It probably cannot afford another similar spike as a result of this war. Anyway, Giorgia Meloni has told the Italian parliament that the killing of the schoolgirls in the attack on the school was completely unacceptable. She expects a proper investigation of that attack and punishment of the people responsible. Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth are not going to like that at all. Donald Trump has suggested absurdly that the Tomahawk missile, which appears to have struck the school, might have been launched by the Iranians, even though the Iranians do not have Tomahawk missiles. Just saying. Anyway, one could see that he is embarrassed. Pete Hegseth has provided no intelligible explanation of what is happening. Apparently, American investigators have already concluded that it wasn't just one American missile that hit the school, but two, one after the other, in some kind of double tap. I'm not going to discuss or anticipate what the investigation is going to say. The key thing is that Meloni, under intense pressure from within Italy itself, is now talking about an investigation of that attack and punishment of the perpetrators, of those responsible, who all the information suggests are going to prove to be Americans. Well, there we are. I've used expressions like debacle to describe what is happening. Catastrophe might soon be a more accurate description. I've said that the Iranians up to now have not published what their objectives in this war are. Well, that is still true officially, but I noticed that Professor Marandi of Tehran University, who, by the way, I've been privileged to have conversations with in the past, and who has always struck me as a level-headed person and somebody who has quite high-level contacts within the Iranian government, even though he is not a member of the Iranian government. Anyway, as Eve Smith has just pointed out in another article on naked capitalism, he is now talking about Iran's objective being nothing less than the decolonization of the Middle East. In other words, not just the removal of all US military bases from the Middle East, but basically the uprooting of American influence in the Gulf. He was even talking about the United States paying reparations to Iran, pointing to the enormous damage that the American bombing campaign of Iran is causing. I am not saying that any of these demands, which, to be clear, so far or not official demands from Iran are realistic. I cannot imagine any plausible scenario in which the United States agrees to pay Iran reparations. Just saying. But, well, we still have to wait and see what the demands that the Iranians finally do make of the United States. And based on these comments of Professor Marandis, they are likely to be very steep ones. Just saying. Anyway, there we are. This is the situation we are in. As I said, it staggers me that we got into this, that the United States, the president and his officials got into this situation. It suggests incompetence, ignorance, arrogance, hubris on a staggering scale. It surpasses that of the Biden administration on the eve of the conflict in Ukraine, which I've discussed exhaustively. And of course, as we've discussed, these two conflicts now are having an effect on each other. Now, I'm going to briefly touch on the situation in Ukraine. Now, the big news here is that yesterday, or it might have been a little earlier, Ukraine conducted a massive strike on the city of Bryansk in Russia with no fewer than seven Storm Shadow missiles. Now, to repeat again, I understand that in order to conduct strikes inside Russia, Storm Shadow missiles need to access data from an American system because GPS does not work inside Russia. So the United States was involved at some level in this attack. Nobody is saying it, but there is no doubt that it is true. And notice that this attack took place again, even as the president of Russia was talking to the president of the United States. The last time they spoke to each other in December, Ukraine, obviously with US assistance, carried out a drone attack on the Valdai residence, the presidential residence at Valdai, where perhaps the Ukrainians and the Americans believed that the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, might be located. Again, the president of Russia and the president of the United States speak. This time, there's no attempt to attack Putin himself, but instead we have this attack on Bryansk. And the Russians are saying that the attack targeted civilian facilities, and they're claiming that at least six civilians were killed in the attack, and there is a storm of protest about it in Russia. And again, inevitably, unavoidably, people are coming back and are saying, why are we continuing to talk to the Americans? Why are we continuing to negotiate with the Americans? Why do we agree to further meetings with the Americans in Istanbul, with the Americans and the Ukrainians in Istanbul in March, when they do such things? I would add that there is another factor at play here. The Russians have repeatedly shown over the course of the last 2 years that they have fully the capability to shoot down the Storm Shadow missiles. The fact that it seems that none of the seven Storm Shadow missiles that were launched against Bryansk were shot down, that strongly suggests that the Russians were taken by surprise. There is, however, and I have to say this, a very ruthless and very tough-minded possibility. The Russians have been busy expanding the buffer zone, as they call it, in Sumy region and in Kharkiv region, in Ukraine's northern borders. Already there are demands in Russia that this buffer zone be expanded further still in light of this missile attack. Expanding the buffer zone in Sumy region might take in the city of Sumy itself, and the Russians are now very close to that, and they appear to be mounting some kind of an offensive towards the city of Sumy. Perhaps it is too ruthless to say that some people in Russia might have said to themselves that an attack on Bryansk might be a price to be paid in order to justify a further expansion of Russian operations in northeastern Ukraine. I would have said that before 2024, but then in 2024, I was informed in advance of that the Russians were luring the Ukrainians into a trap in Kursk region. I was skeptical that the Russians would put their own civilians at risk in that way. But I was told about that before the Ukrainian operation in Kursk region took place, and I've wondered about that ever since. Look, I'm not saying that this is what happened in Bryansk, that this was again set up in that way. I actually balk at thinking this. But in light of what happened in Kursk in 2024, I don't exclude it. For the rest, the Russians, Radovka, have fiercely disputed Ukrainian claims of a successful Ukrainian counterattack in Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye region, where the Ukrainians have been claiming that they've been conducting a counterattack for some time. And in fact, we've had drone footage today, which seems to contradict those Ukrainian claims. And perhaps most interestingly, Putin, over the course of a meeting with Denis Pushilin, the head of the Donetsk regional government, the Russian-backed Donetsk regional government, said that over the course of the last 6 months, the Russian military has captured 40% of the remaining territory in Donetsk region that 6 months ago the Ukrainians still had under their control. And everyone, of course, is now waiting for the big Russian offensive, which is coming in a few weeks' time. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. There'll be more from me soon, obviously. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and Substack. Please remember also to support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.